I welcome everybody here today, newcomers and old-timers. We are working on and talking about Latin American psalmody in relation to Old Testament psalmody and in relation to our own psalms singing. And you will see how it works if you haven't been participating before. First of all, let's get back to this little Portuguese song, which you perhaps remember, some of you remember. Vem, Senhor, vem, Senhor, vem libertar o teu povo. Vem, Senhor, vem, Senhor, vem libertar o teu povo. That's a refrain of a Brazilian hymn, and some of you have already sung it. It's very easy. I'll sing it for you, and we will repeat it once or twice, and then we will go ahead. Vem, Senhor, vem, Senhor, vem libertar o teu povo. Vem, Senhor, vem, Senhor, vem libertar o teu povo. I should say what it means. Come, Lord, come, Lord, come to liberate your people. Come, Lord, come, Lord, come to liberate your people. Vem, Senhor, vem, Senhor, vem libertar o teu povo. Vem, Senhor, vem, Senhor, vem libertar o teu povo. I wanted to teach you another song. Perhaps I will do it in the middle of our session today. That has also a very simple phrase. Sing a new song to the Lord. That's the beginning of Psalm 98, and that was made into a hymn also there. But let's begin first with some psalm contributions which came from you. And I expect that there will be some more still. I have four parts which I haven't read yet last time, which were because they weren't there or I didn't read them. So let me read them simply. I could also ask one of you to read them, but I think I have read them once, at least the three first ones, so I am able now to do it. It's always difficult to get into the handwriting, or sometimes difficult to get into the handwriting of another. The first one, you see, and to remind you, the theme was confidence and petition, you know, or also praise, which is coming up today. I saw the chipmunk, I heard the stream, and I felt the warmth of the sunshine. I smelled the smog-free air. People about me smiled and touched me, and I knew you were here, and I loved you. Second, that part of the previous psalm, which I hadn't been able to decipher at the moment, and I transcribed it for myself now, and I can read it now. A lament is written before this part, and now it turns to confidence and praise. Yet, my God, I know your promise. You said you would be with me always, the ground of my being. Even in the gray mist, I know. No, I can't read my own writing. Oh yes, I see. I know you stand as the mountains behind the clouds, brilliant as the snow-covered peaks in sunshine are your beauty and your strength. You have planted your image in the deepest, this word I was unsure, depth or lens perhaps, because it corresponds to the following line, in the deepest lens of my soul, only let me see you in focus, though through the fog of my business. And the third example, third part or the third psalm. O God, my God of great surprise, I ask for wealth, you make me wise. You send a son of lowly birth to conquer kingdoms of the earth. With humble heart and love so strong, he wipes out all I have done wrong. He doesn't look like any king, but speaks and stirs my heart to sing. When I must touch your majesty, I seek an ancient redwood tree, a mountain crest with peak so high it cuts the blue cloth off the sky, a bubbling creek with laughing sounds, a forest where all life abounds, a perfect snowflake on my hand, a shell found lying in the sand, the ocean's thunder with no storm, a baby's laugh to make me warm. And when I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. I pray for eyes to open wide, for ears to hear who laughed and cried. But God, I thank you most of all for helping me to hear your call. We knew already from the former session that we had a poet among us. And this is again the poet's voice. And I again encourage you not to be discouraged by the poet's voice, you know, so to write in plain language also. I think the poetry is beautiful, but not everybody is able to write poetry like that. And the fourth example I found only recently, it's a nice and good handwriting, and I guess I can read it. Only you, God, know me. With you all is known. You know my cares better than I. I can cry to you when I am alone and misunderstood. I must remind myself that you are never far from me. You will never be far from me. It is not you, but me, that keeps you at a distance. I myself cut myself off from the earth. Lord, give me the strength and trust to keep you walking beside me. Only with your presence can I rise to the special challenge which you have put into my life. God grant that this may be so. Here is the collection so far, and I heard one of us already asked me to how to get a copy of this. I'm thinking that I'm free to give these sheets to anybody who wants to take copies, because they are not, we asked to put no name underneath. So is that all right with you? Mm-hmm. And I also like to repeat my question whether anybody is continuing into the next week here who could write them all up, these texts, and have them perhaps copied for whoever likes to have them. Perhaps somebody can do it. Okay. The response so far is very fine, and I encourage you to write your own psalm of lament, of confidence, of petition, of praise and thanksgiving for tomorrow, and see what the harvest will be tomorrow. Take out half an hour and do it, if you want to. Now, let me very briefly point to three things which we mentioned before, so that the newcomers are a little bit geared into what we have been thinking and doing so far. And then I will go into some new things, but also repeating some aspects of that which we have talked about before. We said in the previous sessions that all psalms are expressions of faith which come out of different environments and different groups. Therefore, if we discuss any psalm and if we write our own psalms, we have to consider our own group and our own being, our own social and cultural and other contexts in order to really understand the texts which there are and understand our own formulations also. That was the first point. We have to consider the backgrounds, the different backgrounds. Old Testament background, Brazilian backgrounds, and United States or modern world or civilized in developed world, let's say, background, you know, industrially developed world. That is my concern. Second, the expressions of confidence, which we talked about last time, day before yesterday, these expressions of confidence in a particular way constitute a community. If I say, you are my Lord, or you are my shepherd, or you are my shield, God, or you are the God of the poor, or you are the helper of the oppressed, these are all expressions of confidence which immediately constitute a community which is behind the psalms. A psalm really never can be said, sung, or prayed only by one person. You may do so at home, sure. You have all liberty. But spiritually, you are lining up with somebody else who is doing the same thing or thinking the same way or already has prayed and sung the psalm like you have. There is always a community around you. Strictly private psalms, I say this well aware of the fact that in the New Testament it said, go into your chamber, lock the door and pray, you know. I do say with this in my mind. Real prayers and real psalms all have a community, a smaller or larger community about themselves, behind themselves. So this is, and the expressions of confidence, I trust in the Lord. Even if I say I, or if we say we, it's apparent, it's obvious, we call to the Lord. And this happens many times in all psalms that there is said, that people say, we do this, we trust, we look for the Lord, we ask him to hear us. And so all expressions of confidence that constitute a community. And thirdly, the petition, we neglected it too much, I guess, this particular element which is so important to all the psalms or to many psalms of the Old Testament and of the Brazilian type, the petitions are the natural outgrowth of a psalm of confidence, a psalm of lament. They usually go somewhere and saying, well, help us, Lord, or do something for us, be with us, and so on. And we should today also think a little bit more about this petition, because I was reminded by somebody of our group last time that we hadn't talked about this enough. You know, what is this, a petition? But that's where we ended last time, and now we continue. And I want to give first, in very brief words, a background of the different types of psalms which we are considering, Old Testament, Brazilian, and ours. You see, the background, I said, is so important. What is this background for Brazilian psalms of lamentation? I guess you can say also for the Brazilian situation that it's so very, so manifold, so complex, that you cannot simply use one sentence to describe it, certainly. But the overriding fact of Brazilian life, especially for these poor people where the psalms come from, which we are considering, the overriding facts are the facts of misery and of being abandoned by God and people, by God and men, by the rich and the mighty, and being left alone and helpless and starving. You see, that's the overriding, that's the basic background. And to remind you of this background, I want to read you a little poem which Manuel Bandeira, a Brazilian poet, wrote, and which is still with me since many years. It's still with me. I translated it for you. It goes like this. I think that's a very concise way of reminding you of these of the background of Brazilian laments, Brazilian petitions, Brazilian praise, Brazilian thanksgiving of the poor. Yesterday, I saw an animal rummaging in the filth of a courtyard. It was looking for something to eat between the garbage cans and in the garbage cans. When it found something edible, it did not stop to look at it. Didn't even take its smell. It gobbled it up greedily. The translation is not very good, I know, but I hope it's at least understandable. The animal was no dog. Neither was it a cat, nor a rat. The animal, my God, was a human being. That, I think, is enough to point to the background of poor, of the sound of the poor of Brazil. Even if not all of them are rummaging the garbage heaps, and I've seen it myself behind our house when a new garbage dump was opened by the city where we lived, in about 200 meters from our house, to fill in the pond, the swampy area, and the garbage trucks came and put in the garbage from the inner part, and immediately there were about 10 families living and working in the garbage piles to sift out, to sort out whatever was usable, either for themselves or for their pigs at home, or to be sold as raw material like paper or metal or something like that. This frequent sight in Latin American cities has disturbed me very, very much. That people are compelled to live on the garbage of other people. And many, many thousands do this. An increasing number do this. But that's enough. Second, the background of Old Testament Psalms. We have touched upon it briefly. The background is very verified, complex. The background is personal sickness. It's persecution by evil-minded enemies. We will talk about the enemy's problem tomorrow. It's in any case, it is danger of life, being endangered, and as far as I suppose, the situation is not that the same way as the Brazilian ones in the Old Testament laments, because usually there is still a circle of friends and relatives left who can support this guy who is, or mostly we suppose are men doing these psalms of laments, possibly women, but the verbs are only male forms, you know, whatever that means. Well, there are usually some people left, I imagine, who supported this sick man or this persecuted, this misfortunate creature who was feeling at the brink of death and abyss and of being left alone. but not perhaps not in every case. Even though this man could turn to a priest and have a worship service for himself done, and that's why these psalms came about. I think the Old Testament situation of a lament is different from the Brazilian situation. I think in antiquity there were hardly any large groups of people really cut off from main society without support and sort of relegated to a status of our poor of this world. I think I have the notion that at least that the conditions have deteriorated in the course of history. I know of some stories in the Old Testament where it says there were some people oppressed by debts and fleeing justice, you know, for some crime, and they went into the wilderness and David picked them up and made a guerrilla type troop out of them. This is true. And he had a strong force of 400 people at one time, and at one time even 800 people of these derelicts, people flipped out or kicked out of society, of the general society. That's true. But I cannot imagine that the problem was so grave as it is in our times, when large segments in Latin America, I would say 50% to 60% of the people are cut off from the society which we consider normal, which we consider a consuming, producing, and political active society. You know, that's the problem. 50% to 60% are cut off from this, from the main body of... But what is main body? They are the majority who are cut off from that society which we consider normal. So that's enough to point out the differences and the Old Testament backgrounds. And thirdly, and this is an open question to all of us, what are the main characteristics of our society from where our psalms rise? If we are the background, we could probably say that we are somewhere in the middle or at the lower end, I don't know, of our large society, but in any case we are participating in a way, in some way, in our general society. We are not marginalized, I believe, all of us, and we are participating in a way in our large, you in your United States society, I in my German and European, forming European society, which is at the horizon. We are participating and profiting and not doing too badly, I guess, all of us. And what is the main characteristics of this society? It has accumulated enormous power and wealth, unparalleled in history, by way of science and technology and knowledge, you know, accumulation, and by way of accumulating also real treasures of capital treasures and so on. So at least from the perspective of the Latin American people, the poor people, we are the powerful. We are in the train, you know, in the we are making up the followership of the mighty ones of this world. Suffice it. I know that this is not perfect and not complete, this description. There are many more things to be said about our situation. There are many more things to be said also in the regard that we are suffering our own needs and our own anxieties and depressions and frustrations in this society, certainly, of course. But one feature of our society is at least this, the accumulation of power and wealth and potentialities in the global sphere. So now we go to our subject, really. Thanksgiving, praise and thanksgiving. You remember that I mentioned in the first presentation that no lamentation in the Old Testament almost no lamentation in the Old Testament and almost no lamentation in the Brazilian scenery is without joy, without breakthrough to that what we could already call praise and thanksgiving. It's curious. You have a you take a psalm like 22, number 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? You know, a very strong psalm of lamentation. And then it starts, I read it to you, it starts, you are enthroned on the praise of Israel, already in the third verse. And then by way of, when we come to verse 20, 21, 22, all of a sudden the psalm changes altogether and starts with full praise. I will give thanks to thee, for you hast, or thou hast heard the clamor of the oppressed, it says. And I will give thanks in the great assembly. I will give thanks with my friends. And there's even a beautiful account of how these people gather together and slaughter an oxen and sit down and have a festive meal. Now, scholars have always been struck by this fact that in one text there can be such a change. And there are many theories about it, how it may come about. For the moment, I'll adhere to the opinion that this is not two parts of one one psalm which are a part which were celebrated or recited with a long time span in between. You know, he first one prayed and lamented, and then he waited to see the effects of his cry and clamor, and then he said, "Okay, God has helped me, and then I will praise." No, I think that the praise immediately belongs to this psalm, because in other psalms of lament it occurs also, in Psalm 69 and 31, for example. And it's part of it. It's anticipated praise. And these people were able to sing laments at the same time break out in jubilant praise and say, "You have heard me, I'm saved, I'm liberated, I saw." And this is the same phenomenon which we come across in Brazil. I'll give you, to demonstrate it, a few more examples. Psalm 22 is a strong example. I don't want to go back to this, but Psalm 31 has the same thing at the end. 31, 19 and 20. How great is thy goodness, God, that thou hast helped me. After much lament, much complaint, and much stark language, how miserable the person, the supplicant, is faring. You know, we may briefly read this, if anybody has it, 19 and 20, the end of 31. No, it's not quite the end, but in a little bit. Does anybody want to read? Yes, not 19 and 20.
Oh, how abundant is thy goodness, which thou hast laid up for those who fear thee, and wrought for those who take refuge in thee, in the sight of the sons of men. In the covert of thy presence thou hidest them from the plots of men. Thou holdest them safe under thy shelter from the strife of tongues.
Fine. Another example, 35, 9 to 10. There it occurs earlier in the liturgy of complaint. 9 to 10, 35. Then my soul shall rejoice in the Lord, exulting in his deliverance. All my bones shall say, O Lord, who is like thee, thou who deliverest the weak from him who is too strong for him, the weak and needy from him who despoils him. It seems in our translation that he is visualizing a future point of view, but I take it that he already is voicing his jubilance, his joy, right here in the middle of his complaint. And another famous example for this is 42:5, which is a refrain in this psalm. 42:5, which runs, "Why are you cast down, O my soul, and why are you disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my help and my God." Well, our translation again pretends to see it praise in the future, but I think in the context of these and other psalms, it is a praise which is already enacted here, you know. And one more example, 69, 30 to 33, I will praise the name of God with a song. I will magnify him with thanksgiving. This will please the Lord more than ox or a bull with horns and hooves. Let the oppressed see it and be glad. You who seek God, let your hearts revive, for the Lord hears the needy and does not despise his own that are in bonds. Suffice it with these examples, they are numerous in the Psalms. If you accept this idea that it is praise at the moment, then we should talk about it perhaps. Or if you also contest this idea.
I was reading some of the poetry from Casalbiga, and the terrible situation under which he works in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And a thought occurred to me, is it also true that there are no psalms of lamentation, no psalms of joy without lamentation? Do the oppressors write psalms? It seems to come out of the marginalized, the suffering, the poor, who know how to lament. But it occurred to me, do the oppressors write psalms? And I'm not aware of any, but I don't know that they don't.
I guess they do sometimes.
And would they be psalms of joy or... only, or
could you think of any examples of psalms of oppressors? Perhaps we take out the word oppressor.
I mean, that's a broad category.
Yes.
It includes us, but
I was thinking the same way when I was reflecting on these psalms. Is it true that we are dealing primarily with psalms of those who are suffering need in the Bible and in Brazil?
That's what I mean.
Does that sound right to you? The biblical psalms contain some examples, at least a dozen, perhaps, or 10, which seem not to be involved with suppression, oppression, or need. I will refer to Psalm 104, for example, the magnificent psalm about creation, how God created the world. You know, or Psalm 8.
They may not be in that particular psalm, but out of this background, out of the same background of suffering and pain, this isolated psalm may be purely psalm of joy, but
not purely. Neither Psalm 104 is purely psalm of joy. When you come to into the 20s of its verses, then you all of a sudden you find a line like, "God, do away with the oppressors." And the psalm is going on for a long time without any sign of this kind of life.
But they are the oppressed who are writing even this psalm.
I would deduce it from this occurrence. I could find out the exact psalm. It's only one line in the later part of the psalm, "But God, do away with the oppressors." Or the magnificent hymn of 139. I don't know whether you know it. It's one of the most beautiful psalms of the Bible, which goes on, "Lord, thou knowest me and thou shieldest all." I can recite it only in German, you know. "Herr, du kennst mich und siehst mich. Ich sitze oder stehe auf, so bist du bei mir." I could read it to you.
No matter where I go, you're there.
Yes, that's the one. It is up to verse 12. It's a beautiful hymn of God's omniscience, you know, he knows everything. He watches me. He cares for me. He takes, you know, I can flee into the netherworld. I can ascend to heaven. Thou art there, you know, du bist da. You are there, God. And all of a sudden it changes, and it gets a violent attack against enemies. And this led people to cut off this part. And I trust that mostly in services, only the first part is cited at all. The violent part against the oppressors and the enemies is left out. Even I think in some psalm translations, I read about a translation, I haven't seen it, which left out all reference to enemies. This will occupy us tomorrow. but it's related to your question. You know, from my knowledge of Old Testament situation, now let me say this briefly. I would say that Israel, along its history, was mostly oppressed and persecuted. And so there were barely any times when it was jubilant and at the peak of power. There are some Psalms which look that way, though. You know, Psalm 48, which is the background for our Luther's hymn, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." Do you know that song, Luther's hymn? "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." Fearful weapon, you know, which destroys the enemies and so on. And this sounds like as if everything was terrifically bomb or good.
as you look at history through the ages, mm-hmm. when everybody's happy and content, nobody writes anything that's powerful. Until something begins to cause the fermentation.
But shouldn't happy and well-provided and well-protected people be able to sing praises all day long?
I doubt it, for somebody isn't.
There's a question to us, you know, there's a question. And I, you know, I hate to say the oppressors, or let's not take this this only image of the oppressor. Let's say the poor and disprivileged and those who are living a well-to-do life without being, you know, rough or brutal or something to anybody. Let's take us as an example. We are innocent people, aren't we? We don't harm anybody. We don't oppress anybody. At least not the direct way. And we let's take us as an example. Shouldn't we be able and shouldn't we sing praises all day long? We do it. I notice a tendency in Holden here to do that, really, to open our eyes and see the beauty of this nature around us, hiking up Hart Lake. Yesterday was like walking in some kind of paradisic situation, you know, with all this calmness, even deer in front of us on the trail, you know, walking calmly away when we came. You know, this is somewhat paradisic. It's almost to be too beautiful to be real. And we are opening, I mean, this kind of situation opens a little our in our daily chorus, you know, and our daily task and responsibilities. I guess we don't have time to sing praises.
Something somebody said the other day: if we're here preparing to go to heaven and haven't learned to celebrate and be joyful here, are we going to be ready to celebrate and be joyful when we get to heaven?
Yes. Perfect, his comment. But why don't let me pose this as a kind of hypothesis? Poor people, my experience. Poor people, and you. I want to include these retarded people you mentioned. You know, they sometimes let's not make it simply a law that you say poor people are happy or can sing praises. I guess that would be wrong too. But poor people and retarded people, we were talking yesterday, they have, in my opinion, sometimes or to a large part, a much higher ability to see what is good to them, to rejoice in simple things. You know? That they break out in joy and say, how beautiful, and they say, thank you, and with their hearts, they say, thank you, if you do something insignificant good to them. I preached a sermon in a Baptist church when I came to the United States here. Our second stop was Connecticut, and my friend is my roommate is a Baptist minister, 26 years in his congregation, and I know the congregation a little already, and I could freely talk to the people, you know. I preached a sermon on the Psalms, of course. And after, there was a group of retarded people there, young people. And one of these girls came to me, and she, with talking difficult, talking was difficult for her. And she remembered a few German words, and I talked to her. And then afterwards, she embraced me and said how grateful she was to have met me, you know, and to have been able to talk. She said, "I can't talk German, you know." Her grandmother had told her the words, and it broke out of her. It's amazing. It's simply an amazing experience which you can make very often. I don't want to make it a rule and say only poor people can sing praises, and only the wealthy or well-to-do people like us we can't do it. I don't think that's true. I hate to make statements like that. You know, they sound so dogmatic, and I hate dogmatics. but at least there is. There is some noticeable, significant distinction, which you see sometimes in poor and oppressed and retarded and non-privileged people, that they can break out in and enjoy things to a degree which you find, and that's exactly our topic today. I can tell you that this, in order to show that this is not only the retarded and only the very poor who can, I wanted to quote a poem by Bishop Herder Camara. I translated it for you, and it runs like this. And you tell me whether this says anything to you or to this topic at this point. "They want to fix my sidewalk." In Brazil, the sidewalk belongs to your house, you know. I don't know whether this is true for the United States. I don't recall. You have to take the snow and the dirt. In Brazil is not snow. In Germany you have to take the snow away from your sidewalk, but there you have to keep it clean. There's no public cleaning of sidewalks. "They want to fix my sidewalk." That's the city does if it's necessary, but the cleaning part is yours. "I had not noticed that it was caved in or was damaged slightly, you know. The few, how do you call this? I didn't have the right word. Do you say a sheath of grass? One sheath?
Blade.
That's the word I want. The few blades of grass growing there, I consider to be beautiful. How can I teach the workers that this grass is much nicer, much more vivid or livelier, I put down here, much livelier than the cold cement they offer me?" And now I find this an impressive and important conclusion which he draws now. "If the concrete stone will win out, it will become a tombstone with this invisible inscription: here lies the most vivid grass, the most courageous, intelligent grass of all the neighborhood." This is to show you that even a very educated man who lives in a big city and has much to do, Bishop Herder Camara, is able to notice a very small thing and comment and reflect and meditate upon it. And draw something like the reason for praise out of this simple, very, very simple observation. the grass which is going to disappear under a layer of concrete. But I can tell you that Bishop Helder Camara is also conscious, and he always, he sometimes talks about this, conscious of the fact that there is no easy way to do that, to observe the tiny things of life and to be grateful and graceful about these things. That's not easy. Why? Because the rush of life, the rush of responsibilities, of tasks, prevents you from it. And what he does is the following. Well, he's educated in the monk, monastery tradition, you know, in the discipline of a monastery and so on. And he rises at night between 2 and 4 o'clock, and he makes his meditation every night. He disciplines himself to get up, because then he is undisturbed by all the sounds of the world, of the busy world, of the productive world, of the advertising world we were hearing about, and so on. He has another beautiful poem. This, unfortunately, I didn't find it to be translated. I don't know. These are poems and meditations of Helder Camara, which he put down in the night hours, in the early morning hours, when nobody disturbs him. And the one about the grass is a reflection of this time. How is our time? Oh, is that possible? Oh my, no.
Let's get up at 2 in the morning.
Oh, let's have a psalm session in the night. I cannot guarantee for me that I will be able to.
You're not of the monastic tradition.
Yes. Yes, but isn't that something? I have so much more to pin down here. What do we do? We have to stop almost, don't we? I wanted at least to stay with this point. I had some more reflections at which I will briefly sketch. I want to tell you one of my deepest impressions of the Brazilian soul and Brazilian piety, which produces these things and breaks out into, came from very poor people who hardly can or barely can read and write. And I have experienced the fact that we as erudites and intelligent and book people, we have a lot to learn from them, really, a very great deal. I mentioned it before to somebody, but I will repeat it here. We had, in 6 years, we had 3 women out of the favelas coming to our house to help us with one day with house cleaning, or sometimes more often, you know, because there's lots of to do in a house like that with 3 little children and some problems of moisture and the how do you call this the
mildew.
Thing?
Mildew.
Yes, there's a black layer over everything which is growing with the moisture. Is that mildew? We call it. You know what I mean, you know. Moth.
Fungus.
Yeah, it's a fungus which grows very quickly and covers everything, you know, and spoils your clothing and everything, and the leather wear, it gets moldy and so. So we had a woman coming in, and all 3 of them were of this type, strangely enough, to know, to have great wisdom of life and no literacy almost. They knocked at our doors and asked for a job, you know, and so we took them in for a day. And one of them had 8 children, and her husband was sick. And my wife, Rita, went to see her in the favela and to see what the conditions were of her life. And she came back and said, it's unspeakable to live there without water and without sewage and without light and on a mud floor, you know. And for 8 people, I guess they had barely 1 or 2 beds. And so on. And this lady, Donna Esther, she always was of such cheerful mind that you can't believe it. She always was sympathetic with our children if they had something, you know, hurt themselves or something like that. She always had a good word for everybody, for us, and a smile. And we knew that she had enough problems at home. Sometimes she brought her little daughter who was retarded, and we think that retardedness often is a consequence of social conditions and had nothing to do with heredity or sickness or something like that. Perhaps with fault or missing food, vitamins or proteins and so on, you know. But this lady was cheerful all the time, and that was such an impressive encounter and convivencia, we say there, you know, living together this day with this woman. It was unbelievable. Well, I have to close, unfortunately, for today. I wanted to mention a hymn which runs in Portuguese, runs like, I give you only the main contents. It runs like this in its contents. You don't need to know the Portuguese words. For a piece of bread and a bit of wine, I saw many people already kill their brothers, something like that. You know, that's the lament part of the hymn. A Catholic priest did this. It shows a high state of reflection, I know. He said, he contrasts these two observations in life. For a piece of bread and a little bit to drink, a gulp of wine, many people kill their brothers. And at the same time, for a piece of bread and a bit of wine, God made himself a nourishing meal for us and made himself the way to walk. You know, it's a play on word, Caminho comes in the end. I guess these two things express beautifully of what we are talking about, the lament and the praise. And one last thing. If you remember the little meditation of Herda Camara, when the grass is beaten down and covered by concrete, it will get this tombstone with this invisible inscription. You see, these people down there in Brazil, they are not so much thinking as we do. I pray and I must receive the help of God personally. This was the troubling question which was still in my mind, which came out of one of our former sessions. What happens if the prayer is unanswered? If I am sick, if I am in need, and I pray and I have perhaps a praying community around me, and God does not answer. I'm stuck with my misery, with my anxiety, with my disturbedness, with my ailment, and so on. What happens? You see, I think our rationale is to think very individualistically. Prayer, answer. And we find this, to be sure, also in the Old Testament. But behind this and around this kind of thinking, there is a larger thinking. God answers, to be sure. God answers even if I stay unanswered. If the grass, in the picture, is covered, there will be an invisible inscription. These people think of the possibility that our prayers stay unanswered, and they see in a larger context that God answers nevertheless. And I wanted to make this point really today, that we have to learn to sing praises, to see the bountiful small gifts and essential and life-bringing gifts in our surroundings, in our personal life, everywhere. Be it so only one one blade of grass, one blade of grass, or one blossom, or one bird, or one child, or one person with a good word. They are signals and symbols of God's presence, and that's the basic, the foundation of psalm singing in Latin America, in the Bible, and with us. So, no, I'm...
But isn't there a parallel with what Luther says in the meaning of the Lord's Prayer?
Yes.
God gives the bread to the just and the unjust. In spite of our prayers, He doesn't.
Yes. And because of our prayer, even because of our prayers, also I would say, not only in spite, because of our prayers, yes. But we may start, and this is a good Lutheran doctrine. We may start from the mercy and the presence of God, which is there. And you know what I deplore most in Germany, probably possibly also here, is our how would I say? I don't have the right word at the moment in English. Our tiredness, our desperation, our feeling there is nothing which can help us anyway.
Despair,
not so strong. It's a kind of despair. It's a milder form of despair. Disappointment as an attitude which says, "Well, we can change the course of the world." Well, I'm not thinking German at the moment. I'm sorry. That's a tricky question for me. And sometimes, you know, when somebody asks me, what is this in German? And I'm talking English and thinking English, and then I don't know the German word. That's terrible, I know, but I'll tell it to you afterwards. excuse me, please. You know, this kind of fatigue, I call it a spiritual fatigue. You know, this kind of letting go and say, well, doesn't work anyway. Our prayer. And that's why praise and thanksgiving are so important, I think, as the moving and carrying force of all psalm singing. I told you in the first session that thanksgiving, joy, praise are the root, the fountain, the base of all things. That's what I wanted to point out today, again. And now we.
I get in Germany. I can't talk English.
That's right. So thank you, and I remind you.
Thank you.
Go back to songwriting. Tomorrow we want to have a dinner.